Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. Helen O'Donnell is in the house.
I am, yeah.
Well, you actually are literally in your house.
Literally in my house, yeah.
I'm literally in my house. Who knew? You could work and do podcasts from home. What a winner.
It's a whole new world has been revealed.
A whole new world. Oh, I don't... Listen, we need to maintain the fiction that we're in a beautifully polished podcast studio. Right, well, Helen's a bit of a legend. She's the CEO of the largest university in the UK after the Open University, Children's University. But she's had a long career in fundraising for schools and universities, and then was CEO of Cheshire Community Foundation before leaping into the world of social enterprise and taking what she describes herself as feisty skills and applying it to a social purpose. So, Children's University, by the way, was named as a top 100 social enterprise of 2021. So it's no small, insignificant outfit she's got running on there. So welcome to the podcast, Helen.
Thank you. Hello. Nice to see you.
And the most importantly, actually, I should have mentioned, and for full clarity, she is a client of my company. Or her company is a client of my company.
Yeah, I'm keeping you going.
keep us busy, whips us into shape. And so I've known Helen for a few years now. I think it's like, well, it's getting on a little bit. But
I think, yeah. 2018, 2019, something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe even longer than that, actually.
And in fact, it reminds me, actually, talking about my company. I always forget, but this podcast is brought to you by the tech department, which is the business I blew up in 2017. And whilst we managed to turn things around, I don't want to do that again. So, which is why I'm talking to Helen. And Helen can tell me what to do because she's hopefully, and all my other great podcast guests. So if you like what we're doing here and you like what you're learning from these podcasts and you appreciate it, please share and review and rate and subscribe and all that good stuff. Because it does, the more you do that, the more people will see it and the more people will get helped by the information. And that is why I'm doing this, is to help other people, not do what I did. So please get on it. That's how you can help us. So Helen's great client, collaborator, partner and leader in her space. But she wasn't always a social enterprise pioneer. I believe your original chosen career was owning a nightclub, Helen.
It was, yeah. I still have a bit of a thing about potentially owning a nightclub. My parents bought me a piece of art for my recent 51st birthday, that is a little snapshot of a kind of Manchester music scene. So it's got stuff about the Hacienda and the Ritz and 42nd Street and all that lot on there to, as they put it, remind me of my youth. So yeah, I did. I wanted to own a nightclub. It wasn't first career choice, actually. First career choice was to do something with Latin and ancient history and maybe archaeology. I quite fancied going on archaeological digs and things. And then I kind of went into the sixth form and discovered boys and alcohol and cigarettes and Manchester nightlife. So I grew up in Stockport in Greater Manchester and went to school in central Manchester and therefore, you know, benefited from all that Manchester had to offer Manchester and Salford had to offer in terms of nightlife and boys and music and everything. And so, spent much of my youth in the Hacienda, either getting into the Hacienda or, you know, not getting into the Hacienda and having to go to various other clubs, getting thrown out of the Hacienda once, I think. So I just had this thing about owning a nightclub, and that's you know, when I was younger, that was what I wanted to do. I think some of that was fueled by rebellion against my parents and rebellion a bit against the system. So I went to I was kind of pulled out of state primary school around about 7, 8, and went into an independent primary school, went through independent secondary school, which was, you know, a very small school. It was also a girls' school, one of the top schools in the country. And there was just a bit of rebellion in there that started to come out against that, as I say, when I discovered alcohol and cigarettes and boys. And so I just had this idea that I was never going to get married, I was never going to have children, I was going to be this really, really strong, independent woman, and I was going to own a nightclub, and that's what I was going to do. And because it just didn't end up like that at all. And then, you know, read some years later the book that Peter Hook and Folk wrote about actually the disaster that was running the Hacienda. Well, it all went horribly wrong and kind of went, oh, yeah, I'm kind of glad I didn't do that. But I still have this little bit of me that would love to do something like that. And I was very lucky that throughout my career, you know, I met some amazing people as well. So I did, you know, once have lunch with the amazing Tony Wilson. And so that little bit of that dream was fulfilled in some ways, but not quite fully, or as it should have been.
There's still time yet.
There's still time.
I could be
the new Peter Stringfellow.
I think you should be, that's your new career path after being a social enterprise leader, is to become the new Peter Stringfellow of the North.
Maybe there's something in there combined, some sort of social enterprise that's around nightclubbing and nightlife and that kind of stuff.
Maybe there, you joke, but oftentimes I find that you need to take jokes seriously, because often there's a seed of truth or breakthrough thinking that you don't take seriously, but actually is the path. So maybe there's something in that.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, and just for, is that the book, How Not to Run a Club, the Peter Hook book?
I think that's what it's called. It's got the kind of black and yellow thing, the diagonal. Yeah,
I'll dig out the link and put it in the show notes, because I read that book and I would highly recommend it, because I did spend my formative years at the University of Manchester in the early 90s. And there was a couple of nights that he references in that book that I was at. And so I perhaps was on the podium somewhere, dancing alongside you, Helen, at some point in 1993. But so you've had this sort of rebel streak in you.
Yeah.
From your kind of privileged middle-class upbringing, you decided to sort of flick the rods at your parents, turn over the table and go off and be a bit of a kind of a naughty rebel.
Yeah, still am.
Yeah, I was going to say you still are. I mean, I've read on a quote, you said you've made a life and subsequently a career out of being a strong, outspoken, feisty woman. So going back to that kind of early stage, you were perhaps in your teens there. So what are the kind of attributes you had that fueled that?
You know, one of the big things that I took from my education and the type of school that I went to was the confidence that built in us as young women. So, you know, I remember going through secondary school constantly being told that we could do anything and we could be anything. And so, you know, there was that kind of confidence instilled in you, which I think for me came out as more than confidence. It came out as attitude, I think. And I think, you know, I think I was feisty from being quite young. If my parents were here now, they would tell you a highly amusing story about my usual summer attire on holiday in Blackpool and various places was a bikini top and a pair of red wellies and nothing else. So I kind of had this attitude from a really young age, I think. But I think that was fueled by this kind of confidence that was instilled in us, you know, that we could be anything and could do anything we wanted to. And then I think what happened was I ended up having major spinal surgery when I was 17. So I was told when I was probably about 15, 16 that I had a condition called scoliosis, which is where your spine grows in an S shape, as opposed to growing straight. And it's something that happens to quite a lot of girls more than boys, I think, and something that can happen to you in puberty. So they used to do this test, I don't know whether they still do, at age 11 in schools, where they used to get you to basically touch your toes and they'd look at your spine and see if it was straight. And mine was, and then it developed a bit later on. So I went into kind of my sixth form life and my stage of life when others were learning to drive and everybody was going out and having a really great time and stuff. And, you know, as I say, we were discovering boys and alcohol and all that kind of stuff, nightclubs, etc. Having been through major spinal surgery and having to wear a cast, basically, so a plaster of Paris cast, like you would if you broke your leg or your arm. And I wore that as like a vest for 12 months. And so I was very, very conscious of how I looked. And I used to get a load of comments from people. I remember, you know, there was a group of lads who called me Helen Back. They thought that was highly amusing to call me Helen Back, you know, going to Helen Back and all that kind of thing. So I rebelled against all of that. And my kind of way of coping with that was to go to the other extreme. So to kind of be the party girl, despite what I was going through with all of that. And then because I did that, and because I was that feisty, bolshy kid who, despite being told by my headmistress that maybe I wanted to take time out and resit my year, my kind of upper sixth year at school and stuff, went, no, I'll be fine. I'll do my A-levels, da-da-da-da. Crashed and burned. Really didn't do as well as I thought I was going to do. And all of a sudden, that whole kind of being told that you can be anything and you can do anything and you're going to be really, really successful because you've been to this wonderful school, came just crashing down around me. And there was just this big realization of, actually, I can't, because I've done really, really poorly in my exams and stuff. And I went off to do a degree that I'd never imagined doing in my life. So I went off to do modern languages. I went to what was then Wolverhampton Polytechnic, which was, this sounds awful, but given the type of education I'd had, it was like a massive come down. You know, it wasn't what was expected of me at all. But I went off to do that. And I think I was suddenly thrown into a position where I was with a lot of people who'd chosen to be there. You know, they'd chosen that as the institution that they wanted to study at, because they weren't necessarily going to get, you know, the kind of grades that I'd been expected to get. They were there, they wanted to do that course. And I was suddenly kind of like, oh, actually, you know, I've kind of been, I suppose, really, really kind of up myself. and you know, and actually I am obviously really quite bright, and but you know, I've got this amazing opportunity, and at the same time, you know, I'd kind of got my parents in the background going, oh well, this has been a bit of a disaster, you know, we've spent all this money on this amazing education and now you're ending up at this place we've never even heard of. You know, and it looks a bit of a dump, and oh my god, it's all a bit, you know, multi-ethnic, and this isn't what we used to kind of think. It all looks a bit dodgy. And it just, that just set me on this path of just kind of like, I don't know, being even more bolshy, and even, you know, the attitude really started to come out there. And I must have been horrible. I think I was really, really horrible. I think at uni I must have, you know, had I met me, I'd have just been like, oh God, who is this person? But yeah, I don't know. I think there was probably a lot of anger tied up in that around, you know, the whole back up thing and the whole not doing as well out of school as I thought I was going to do. And I think that kind of set me on a path of getting angry and feisty and bolshy about things. And that's where this whole kind of then kind of social injustice, wanting to do something about inequalities and stuff, came out. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of where I came at it all from.
No, it's interesting. And so there seems to be this kind of like sort of big bang moment in your teens kind of thing, where be it hormones, alcohol, back operations,
or a combination of all that.
A-level disasters, middle-class parents' expectations, and a kind of perhaps colliding with reality in terms of your ego, in terms of where you thought you would be or whatever. So this kind of like mixture of this alchemy of elements have created this energy. As John Lydon once said, anger is an energy.
Yeah.
So you've got this fuel in you. So how did that start to express itself then, as you're going into your 20s?
I could give you some really kind of tangible examples of how it started to express itself. So I remember I'm really good friends still with the girls I lived with at uni, you know, so we've kept in touch, you know, 30 odd year friendship, you know, godmothers to each other's kids and all that kind of stuff. And we meet up regularly still. And I remember my best friend out of that crowd, who is also a Helen, and Helens tend to be very feisty. I've come across a lot of Helens in my time at school and work and in different places. We all tend to be a bit similar. And I remember her saying to me a few years ago, we were talking about kind of first impressions of each other and, you know, things we remember about meeting. And she recalled this story about the first time that she saw me. I was in the kind of reception bit of our halls of residence, screaming at some poor woman behind the desk because a bus or a coach for something hadn't turned up. And she said, and I just remember seeing this girl, she said, who was like immaculately dressed and her hair was perfectly coiffed and she was all made up and whatever, which was me. She said, standing, just giving this poor woman absolute hell with a crowd of other students behind her, kind of going, yeah, yeah, what she says. Yeah, we'll support you. We're backing you up, kind of thing. She said that was my first memory of you. And I've spent the last 20 odd years being scared of you. I was just like, oh my God. I was like, I can't believe that my best friend is saying this about me. So it came out in kind of ways like that. And I remember we had rats in our student house in our final year, which was great. And so it was things like I'd be the person who was sent to go and have a go at the landlord, you know, with everybody standing behind me, because it was just those sort of things were seen as Helen's job. I remember a nightclub, running theme, nightclubs, you know, student nightclub, one of my friends not being very well, and there was a really narrow staircase, really narrow, steep staircase, which was the way in and the way out. And I just remember her not being well and standing at the top of this staircase, which was full of people entering the nightclub, and literally standing at the top and just shouting, effing move. And it was like a parting of the sea, you know? People like just moved out of the way for her. So it came out in ways like that. So I think at uni, I was kind of really seen as this angry, angry person. But then it also, I think, came out in ways that were just rebelling more and more. So I think my husband would kill me for saying some of this stuff. But my parents always had this idea that I would, you know, marry a nice kind of Manchester grammar boy, you know, be a doctor or a lawyer, and you know. And so I deliberately went out of my way to wind my parents up. In terms of the things that I did, in terms of the choices that I made, it almost became a bit of a hobby. And my mummy, you know, she regularly says to me now, why can't you do anything normal like normal people do? Why do you always have to go to the extreme and do something completely completely different? So I hooked up with my husband during my finals at uni, and they were horrified when they first met him, absolutely horrified. I mean, he was kind of extremely hungover, and there was a wheelie bin propping him up at the time. But he was, you know, he was a painter and decorator. He was covered in tattoos. He was absolutely not what they had envisaged for me. I ended up getting pregnant, I think, within 6 weeks of meeting him, straight out of uni, moved in with him. Horrified parents. My husband's parents were thrilled. They couldn't believe he'd found somebody so posh. They thought it was great. And so everything my parents had in mind for me, in terms of the education, in terms of uni, in terms of who I would end up marrying, in terms of me coming straight out of uni and becoming a mum, not having a career, etc. Yeah, it was like everything they expected of me got thrown back in their faces. And it wasn't, you know, I wasn't trying to do that at all. I think it was just me finding myself and finding my way. And yeah, I've never gone about things the way that as my mum says, most normal people would go about things. But I think that's just me, and maybe they should have realised that when I was running around in a bikini top and a red pair of wellies in the summer of 76 or whatever it was.
Again, so it's all kind of this counter going against what parents want, maybe what the society thinks you should do, maybe what you, quotes, should be doing. And fast forward, I remember you said, you in your midlife crisis, rather than getting a Harley Davidson or a Toy Boy, you dropped out and joined a charity. And I just want, just before we get into the Children's University and that kind of being a CEO of a charity sort of thing, this you said that, again, that was disappointing your parents. But what I'm interested in here is your parents seem to be an avatar here for doing things, quotes, normally, or being, quotes, respectable, right? And I'm just curious to sort of, you know, I think it's probably bigger than your parents, really. It's this sort of going a lateral move against what society tells you should do.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
So let's go. So we've had various snippets of your, you know, self implosions of what you should be doing through your early life. Let's zoom up to your midlife crisis now. What fueled that? Why did you do this lateral move to go from a kind of respectable position in the, I guess, Greater Manchester area in Cheshire, where it's probably quite well heeled and lots of kind of middle class people, to sort of drop out and become a CEO of a charity that's about sort of helping social justice issues or underprivileged kids particularly?
I think, again, it was that kind of, it was fueled by anger in a way, and I think it was only as I got older and I've looked back that I think I became grateful for all those things that I was rebelling against. I think it took me getting older and looking back in retrospect to go, actually, you know, I was incredibly lucky. It was incredibly lucky, you know, I was actually very, very lucky to have my parents and have my parents be those middle-class parents and, you know, my dad be in a brilliant job. My dad, you know, my dad retired at 52. So my dad retired, you know, a year older than I am now. And, you know, was fortunate that he was from that generation that, you know, was able to retire early and retire early, you know, being quite, you know, quite well off. So I kind of did that thing of kind of looking back and going, actually, do you know what? I was really, really lucky. I was very privileged. Despite rebelling against all that, I was incredibly privileged. I was very, very lucky to have, you know, the education that I did have. It was a phenomenal education, you know, and not everybody gets that. And I think it was, one of the things that triggered it was my husband had a conversation with his parents. I think he was 47 at the time, so this is about 5 years ago, I think. He had a conversation with his parents about, you know, education and stuff and school life and that kind of thing. And I remember this conversation distinctly because his parents were talking about like his last parents' evening. So my husband left school at 16, went to do an apprenticeship with his uncle, a painting and decorating apprenticeship. But it turned out during this conversation that at the last parents' evening that his parents went to, his teachers said to his parents, would you encourage him to stay on in sixth form because he is university material? And his parents had never told him that conversation took place. So it was predetermined in many ways that he was just going to go and work for his uncle and do this apprenticeship as a painter and decorator. And not so much that being predetermined by his parents, but it being predetermined almost by the society around him. And it struck me the difference between our two upbringings and that whole issue around, you know, there was no difference in us in terms of our talents or our skills or, you know, what we could have done academically. The difference was where we were born, where we were brought up, the societal attitudes around, you know, kind of, I suppose, lifelong learning and education and what your career path should be and that kind of stuff. And I started getting really, really angry about it because I was in a position where I could see that, you know, we I suppose we were supporting our children in the way that I'd been supported. And yet, you know, going back to where he grew up, you know, you were seeing the kind of, I suppose, upbringing and attitudes and kind of lack of aspirations that he'd grown up with around him were still there, you know, 30, 40 years later. And because I'd kind of come through working at the Community Foundation, which was all around kind of community development and what communities could do for themselves, if, you know, if support was there financially, I just started getting really, really angry about it. And that's where I kind of went, you know what, now is the time to put my kind of personal passions and personal experience, and that kind of lived experience, into trying to do something to address that. And let's kind of use that anger and feistiness to do something about it. So I kind of went into this, I'm going to get on my soapbox and do something about it. And Children's University presented me with that opportunity. It was also, it had been through, as a charity, it had been through some interesting times from a governance and finance perspective, and it looked hugely challenging as well. And I think there was an element of that personal and professional life being able to come together, and me to be able to kind of fuel that anger a bit more. Yeah, but also, you know, that opportunity to actually grab something that was going to be really, really challenging and just go, I'm going to give that a go and see how I get on, because I'm convinced I've got the skills to do it. And that was one of those moments where everybody around me went, oh, are you sure? You're absolutely crazy. Why on earth are you leaving something that you really settled in and is going really, really well and making that jump to do something which you've got no idea whether it's going to be successful or carry on or. But again, that's they not doing anything the way normal people do it.
Yeah, it's just funny because I think a lot of entrepreneurs are a bit like that. Is that you could see something there that others couldn't. Yeah, so it made sense to you.
Yeah, it's for me, you know, there's got to be challenge there. I've got to take myself out of my comfort zone. And I think, you know, up until this point, I've probably, you know, around about 3.5-4 years into something, I've jumped ship and changed direction, because it's when things get settled and when things are going well that I kind of go, you know, this is a bit boring. I need to do something else that's going to scare me. It's going to give me butterflies.
There's something in that, though, like that kind of the fear or the scare, is it something that scares you, is fearful and gives you butterflies? Well, that's a nervous energy again, that you've got to prove yourself. You've got to test yourself out in the wild with something new and different and exciting. And this sort of, you said here, got to take myself out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's kind of a recurring theme, the comfort zone being defined in a different way. But the comfort zone, you get comfortable and you throw yourself out of that. So just having, just observing that as a trait, what do you think this sort of, looking back, what have you learned about yourself, perhaps, having done that a few times over your career?
You know, I've learned that it's absolutely the right thing for me to do. And I've also learned that I think in many cases it's the right thing for other people to do, but other people don't always recognise it. So I've been really frustrated over the years when I've seen colleagues not push themselves, not take that leap of faith, or people that have worked for me not take that leap of faith. That's been a massive frustration. So, you know, I can think of a couple of people who have had really great opportunities come their way, but they've been worried to take those opportunities because they think they're not quite ready, or they don't think they've got enough experience. So they need to stay in the job that they're doing, or they need to stay where they're doing to get more experience before they can take that on. And I've tried to say to people, look, you know, if that opportunity is coming your way, somebody out there is prepared to take a leap of faith in terms of you as a person. And so you take that leap of faith, you do it. And I've watched people hang around in roles or in companies I think, far too long sometimes, which has been a massive frustration. And I've just wanted them to kind of take that leap of faith and do it. I think the other, do you know what, the other big thing I've learned about myself, which is a real surprise, and I think will come as a surprise to you, knowing me and after everything I've said, and this has come purely, it's been forced by COVID, but I think I've also learned that my comfort zone, or what I think or thought of as being my comfort zone, is not necessarily my comfort zone. So one of the things I have learned about myself massively, and this is during COVID and lockdowns, is that whole never going to get married, never going to have children, despite the fact I have got three kids. but that whole I've got to get out there, I've got to prove myself, I've got to be this angry, bolshy, feisty woman, I've got to get to, you know, prove myself and reach my full potential in a career or what have you. And that makes me a better person for my kids, because my kids see, you know, this work ethic and they see this strong woman, etc. Isn't necessarily maybe the thing that I have actually been looking for, because what COVID has actually shown me is, you know, I actually really love being at home with my kids. And I, you know, my oldest daughter's, 27? And COVID suddenly made me go, do you know what? I've missed out on my kids' lives. So maybe this strong, feisty career woman isn't quite the thing that I was looking for.
Wow, that's a bit of a revelation.
It is a revelation, isn't it? It is. And I think it's just that. I'm not saying for one minute, you know, I could give up work and be a full-time mum. And, you know, and I do think I would have done my kids a disservice had I been a full-time mum, or indeed a part-time mum at home, because I've worked full-time the whole time, and, you know, that they've been around. But I think it suddenly made me realise all the stuff that I'd missed out on. And maybe I've let them down a bit by not being around as much as I could have been around.
Wow, that's how did that feel when you had that moment? And did that, was that a moment of clarity, or was that creep up on you through lockdown?
I think it crept up on me. I think there was that initial kind of, oh God, what have I been doing all these years, doing massive commutes and spending, you know, 3 hours plus a day sitting on trains or sitting in my car and what have you. There was that initially. And then there was the, oh yeah, I actually, you know, love working at home. And it was all a bit of fun at first, wasn't it? You know, homeschooling and all that hilarity. And I'm very, really, really fortunate in that my youngest daughter is 10, so she's just gone into year 6 at primary school. And I'm really fortunate in that the primary school is literally a couple of hundred yards down the road. So I can walk her to school and go and pick her up and that kind of stuff. And it was doing that, I think, that just made me go, oh, do you know what? I've missed out on so much. And I just think there was just this slow creeping realisation that I've put so much into work and career. And maybe a lot of that is kind of, well, I know a lot of that is almost making up for the, you know, I went to uni, came out basically mum. Didn't do what I could have done, and, you know, trying to creep back, you know, trying to kind of claw some of that back, really. And there's that kind of realization of, actually, did I need to do that? Could I have had a better work-life balance? I'm sure I could have done and I should have done. And actually, I'm not sure. And I've even said, you know, if it came down to going back to, you know, 3 hour round commutes and doing that kind of stuff, I would probably now walk away.
Really?
Yeah.
This is funny, isn't it? I mean, I know exactly what you mean, because I've had a, not the same, but similar experience through lockdown. And it's funny, I've had a series of revelations about subconscious drives that perhaps have acted as saboteurs in my life. Things like wanting to prove myself, or needing to be respected, or control, or perfectionism. These are all things that you perhaps just take, that are happening, and you don't know why, and then you create a narrative around them that explains why, because I'm a feisty woman.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Or I'm a creative guy, entrepreneur. I'm an innovator. That's the thing I like to tell them the story. I'm an innovative guy, so I have to be commuting to London and traveling over here and working really late and not going to this thing and not going. But actually, it's like, no, it's just a bunch of subconscious drives that are nested in your upbringing, in your needing to prove yourself about the education thing in your case, that are articulating themselves, and you wrap a story around it that says, yeah, well, I'm an innovative, entrepreneurial, feisty person.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's just you saying that, actually, it's just kind of reminding me. I sound like I'm blaming my parents for loads of stuff, but I'm not.
Bloody parents.
Bloody parents, yeah, they're responsible for everything. But I remember, you know, certain situations, and this is, you know, a few years ago, this is before I became a CEO of anything, but a few years ago, I always remember being, whenever we were in like social situations with my parents, there'd be this really awkward moment where people would like, you know, they'd be talking about me and my sister or stuff, and they'd be able to say, well, my sister's a nurse, my sister's a paediatric nurse, and her husband's a policeman, you know, and then they'd get to me and they'd kind of be like, oh, Helen works in an office. And they'd never actually be able to tell anybody what I did, you know. And it was kind of like, oh, so it was almost like there was almost this kind of need to reach a kind of title or a status that they'd be able to go, she's the chief executive of a charity.
Yeah. Well,
because up until that point, you know, that whole period of doing fundraising and development work and all that kind of stuff, they were just like, I've got no idea what she does. Just don't get that at all. So she works in an office.
It's funny. Well, my wife in my entire career has not been able to describe what I do, but like it's kind of. But I know exactly what you mean. It's trying to get to a point where you're proving to the world that you're this status, perhaps you're this. You've proven your worth, and I think that's. I've done a lot of work on myself, by the way, for my own mental health, and it's been quite an interesting few years. Just. Getting into some of these deeper things, but often that's humans are quite simple, really. We need love, we want acceptance, we want to be part of the tribe. Yeah, that's what's driving it, and that's what drives everybody. And so I consider myself the need to be respected, the need to be seen as somebody credible. Well, why would that be a thing, right? Well, it's the need to be accepted, to be loved, and so there's something, a kink or a quirk in us. Me, I can't speak for you, that is drives that. And I think that's a common theme in many people, right? And so the striving for success. It's funny, Elon Musk is trying to get to Mars. And one of my podcast guests is a guy called Dan Sullivan. Dan Sullivan is sort of broadly connected into that kind of world. And he said, what did he say? He was, but maybe when I walk on Mars, Daddy will love me. About Elon Musk. Right? Because Elon has apparently said that, I've not read his book, but he had a difficult relationship with his father. And so at what point do you get that parental love? When you walk on Mars? Maybe that's when it happens, right? And I thought it was really telling, because I thought, wow, yeah, that's it. What drives people to reach these literal, in his case, heights? You or me or anyone listening. And often it's these things that are really deep. So and so this is what I found from my own personal inner exploration. And it's interesting, as you talk, that's what's happened for you, I guess, is this lockdown has bubbled up this little insight.
It's really interesting, actually, what you say about that and about credibility in particular. And I think that is a major kind of part of it. I think, you know, the fact that I was... And I think I've put a lot of this on myself, to be honest. You know, I say, you know, right through my career, I've had major imposter syndrome. I still have it now. But I think I've put a lot of that on myself because I don't necessarily feel credible. And I think it's because of that kind of, you know, feeling the need to be credible or be seen to be credible. So I think there is that, you know, there's that subconscious. I didn't do what school expected me to do, you know, I went to an institution where I was not expected to go to. I did a degree that I wasn't expected to do. I ended up with somebody that I wasn't expected to be with. You know, I ended up being a mum at, 23, which, I never expected myself and nobody else expected. You know, I'm in a relationship that nobody expected to last. You know, people, we are poles apart, me and my husband, and that's probably why we've lasted this long. They say opposites attract, don't they? But nobody would have looked at that relationship and gone, you know, they've known each other for 6 weeks and she's pregnant and that's going to last. Mm. You know, and here we are nearly 30 years, you know, later. And I think there's just been that thing of needing to be credible. And as you say, you know, so my sister then went off and she trained to be a nurse and, you know, and there was that whole expectation of, I don't know, I suppose the traditional expectations that my parents have of, you know, she's my older sister, she'll get married first, she'll have children first, then Helen will get married and then she'll have children. And because I didn't do that in the right order, because I threw all that up in the air, subconsciously, I suspect you're absolutely right, I've been fighting all that time to make myself seem credible and to make myself as a mother who'd said, you know, I'll never get married, I'll never have children, I'm going to own a nightclub. I've then got to prove that I'm a credible mother to everybody. I've got to prove that I'm in a credible relationship because nobody thought that would be a credible relationship. And I went down a career path where nobody could explain what I actually did. So I've got to build credibility in that. And then I think, you know, partly because I was then this kind of young mum going into the workspace. And this is going to sound ludicrous, but because I'm also quite diminutive in height and, you know, physically quite diminutive, I think I always felt I had something to prove and I had to prove myself to be credible. So I've always had this thing of feeling like, and in a charity world, when you're working with boards, you know, many of whom are men, you know, there's an awful lot of white middle-class men of a certain age in charity boards and of a certain status as well. I've always felt like this teenager. I almost revert back to I'm a really young little person and I'm sitting here in my, you know, sometimes quite weird and funky clothes and jewellery and stuff and my tattoos and I feel like I've got to prove myself and I've got to be credible all the time. And I remember actually my first job, I got so wound up with a man who worked there in terms of things he would say to me. He once asked me, he was into amateur dramatics, and he once said to me, would I like to play the part of a Swedish au pair in one of his productions because I looked the sort? And you know, and this is nowadays, you'd kind of go, whoa, you know, and we'd all be up in arms about somebody saying something like that. But, you know, I kind of went away, seethed to myself. And then, you know, this was in the days of, remember when you used to write like words to have on a screensaver and then slowly across the screen, and we all thought that was really, really, you know, high tech and funky. I actually for several years have as my screensaver packaging doesn't equal performance. And that's kind of something I've carried through with me. But I think I've put this kind of massive weight on my own shoulders about I'm an imposter and I need to prove my credibility. And you know, and maybe I've done the wrong thing by rebelling and being this kind of angry, feisty woman. I've put that weight on myself of having to then prove that I can be that, but I can also be credible and can, you know, professionally present myself with gravitas and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, essentially, I think you could put a value judgment on that or not. I mean, and again, that's that, you probably don't need to. But I think what's interesting is sometimes you're, well, you said about you revert back to this being a teenager in front of these high status, middle-aged dudes. And it probably is something in that. It's like probably an authority thing, or there's probably some kind of weird trigger that's going on there and you know, where you kind of suddenly don't feel like you're, you know, enough, right? And that you don't fit in the mold, therefore you're wrong because you put a value judgment on that. And I think there's a bit here of again, it's about sort of recognizing that and being aware of it.
Yeah.
And then it dissolves or can dissolve. And I think there's a bit almost like you could, and listen, I'm no psychiatrist or psychologist, but it's like, it's almost like the who you're fighting against, right? like, where's you're sort of swinging at people and situations and problems, windmill swinging at, like, let me at him, right? And maybe that fighting doesn't need to be quite as fighty, right? I don't know, like, and it's interesting, but and the only reason I'm saying that is because over my middle, I mean, I'm 48, but my middle age, I'm kind of like learning that I don't have to be running as fast. I don't have to be putting so much energy into every line item of everything I'm doing, however that is expressed. Maybe I can just be, you know, just be yourself and not have to be this other thing. This, you talk about amateur and dramatics, performer, a persona, something else, an actor of somebody you feel you should be. But how do I, what's in your heart, or how's that aligned to your soul, not just your mind or your intellect or whatever?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think I spent years, trying to look the part, trying to act the part, and there's that whole thing around just being authentic. And I think, you know, it probably came about, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, something like that, where I just went, do you know what? This is me. This is me. And I'm just going to wear my heart on my sleeve. And at work, I wear my heart on my sleeve. You know, I'm not going to try so hard to fit in. And if people don't like it, then I'm really sorry, but this is me. And, you know, and as you get older, you know, it gets worse. So I am just now, I'm just like, do you know what? I don't care whether people like my hair, or I don't care whether people look at me and go, oh, she's wearing trainers. You know, I'm just like, I just genuinely don't care. Think what you will. I don't give a toss.
Love it. I think that should be your T-shirt collection. Think what you will. I don't give a toss. Seriously, occasionally on this podcast, I get people coming out with stuff like that. I'm like, this is, I'm going to make a T-shirt range, like, of like quotes from my podcast guests. Think what you will. I don't give a toss. On that particular bombshell, I'm conscious of time slightly here because we're edging towards the end of our podcast time together. I'm going to shoehorn through the sort of gears here and switch. I want you to tell us a little bit about, just quickly, because Children's University is a fantastic charity.
Yes.
Just tell us quickly about the charity and about what you do, and where can people find out more about it and or help?
Yeah, sure. So in a very brief little snapshot of Children's University, basically we encourage kids to develop a love of learning. So that happens outside of school. So we all know, you know, the formal education system happens, but there's so much going on outside school. And we have this belief that learning can basically happen anywhere, at any time and anyhow, and it will benefit you. And we also know that kids from lower socioeconomic backgrounds face a lot of barriers to doing some of this stuff. So there's a real kind of vast inequality between, you know, kids like me who went to independent schools and got to do loads of stuff at weekends and in the evenings, and benefited from that in terms of academically and the skills that they developed and, you know, social capital, all that kind of stuff. There's this huge gap between those kids and kids who don't get that kind of stuff, simply because of where they're born and where they grew up. So we encourage as many kids from as early as an age as possible by basically having this internship scheme. So we get them to go out and do stuff, we reward them for doing that, and then we celebrate them doing that. And we try and link them into loads of different things in their community and national learning stuff. We have around about 112,000 kids get some sort of Children's University award every year, and it is proven that what they do will actually improve their attainment. So in terms of like their key HQ SATs, and you know, as they go through secondary school, they will do better academically, and therefore their outcomes, you know, their life outcomes are highly likely to be better. So we do that. We are found all around the country because we're a national organization, and we work in Scotland and in Wales, and we have some stuff going on in Australia as well, which is brilliant. The website, if people want to have a look and find out more information about us, is all the W's. johnsuniversity.co.uk, and there's some really interesting stuff on there. So we recently done a State of the Nation report, which is basically a national picture of what kids do outside of school to boost their learning. And that covers actually the kind of whole period of COVID. So it covers lockdowns as well. And it's got data that was generated through our digital platform, John's University Online, created by the tech department. Woo, exactly. So it's got data taken from, I think it's around about 22,000, 23,000 user accounts on there, and builds up a picture around that. So, you know, do take a look at what we do.
I would very much highly recommend everybody does that. And it's a great charity. And I'm really proud to be able to be part of the team that's helping you tell that story. What's quite neat, actually, and I really do feel proud about this, is the fact that the data from those 23,000 kids on the platform we built with together with you tells a story. And that is built on real world, you know, at scale information about really helping people. And I feel, you know, that's a great purposeful thing for me and my team, and I know for you. So check it out, everybody. There's a great bunch of information on there. So childrensuniversity.co.uk. And what about you, Helen? Where can we find you on the internet? And
where will you find me lurking?
Lurking on the internet. Yeah.
So I'm on Twitter. I am Helen O'Donnell 6, as in the number 6. And you'll find me on LinkedIn as well. I'm not a huge social media person, because I am, as I'm sure you will have heard me say many times, Dan, I am a complete technophobe, self-professed technophobe. But you'll find me looking about there. And if you want to get a kind of idea of my anger around this and where it all stems from, I did a TEDx talk a few years ago, I think back in 2017, which is out there. So if you just Google TED or TEDx and Helen O'Donnell, you will find that. And do have a listen to it, because I think that gives you a sense of where this all comes from.
Well, that's a great shout. I think that's everyone should check that out. I will be checking that out. Check her out on Twitter and LinkedIn. She's also on a podium in a nightclub somewhere near you, blending social justice skills and nightclubbing.
That makes me sound like a lap dancer.
Oh, wow. Oh. Dance floor.
Or a stripper.
We did say about Stringfellows. You did say about Stringfellows.
So for many a year.
You brought it up.
Been on some sort of podium.
Well, on that bombshell, we should wrap up our conversation. But that's been really so fantastic. Helen, you're an absolute star. And
it's been like therapy. It's been really good, actually.
Well, there you go. We're on the couch again, they're sort of spilling your guts. Well, thank you for therapizing in front of all of our amazing, incredible listeners. So we will see everybody next time. And thanks, Helen. I'll see you soon. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box, just enter it in, and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.